Robles here.
Good morning. We're going to go ahead and open up the Senate Committee on Judiciary. We're going to start off. I have a carryover that's going to be very quick, and I promised that they were going to go first. So I'm going to go ahead and open up the public hearing on 2987.
Thank you, Chair Prezonsky, members of the committee. House Bill 2987 renames giving false information to a peace officer for service of a citation or for arrest on a warrant to giving false information to a peace officer in connection with a citation or warrant, and expands the crime to include a person providing false information to a peace officer when there is an outstanding warrant. There are no amendments. There is a minimal fiscal and no revenue impact.
All right. Thank you. Tim, why don't you give us the play-by.
Thank you, Chair Prezonsky, members of the committee. Tim Colahan from the Oregon District Attorneys Association. The district attorneys are bringing this bill before you because of a case that came down in 2014 called State versus Lusk. And essentially, Lusk held that in order for a person to commit the crime of providing false information to a police officer, the police officer has to know there is a warrant existing for the person at the time they ask for identification, and then the person gives a false name or date of birth. That is not how the statute was ever. I don't think DAs applied it that way in the field. Police officers thought it applied any time somebody gave a false name and there was a warrant out. This bill will simply make a slight change to provide that if there is a warrant out for a person and an officer asks for identification, they give a false name, that constitutes the crime. It makes it a Class A misdemeanor, which it already was, and there is a little or no fiscal impact.
Yeah, and I'll just add, this is for clarification, because the way the court interpreted the statute, the officer had to have knowledge prior to that question, and clearly they may not know that until they actually get a name and actually are able to determine whether or not there is any warrants out on them. So this is to just clarify the statute that we had. Is there any questions, Senator Thatcher?
Does the person need to know that there's a warrant out? Sometimes I hear of people that don't know there's a warrant out for them.
Chair Prezonsky, Senator Thatcher, no. There's no knowledge requirement. The person knows that there's a warrant out. Obviously, in order to find out if there is a warrant to run a check on the individual, the police have to get a name, and they won't know that. They won't have that information until they find out the person's name.
And may I ask another one?
You may.
What constitutes a false name? If they go by a name and they tell you that name, or do they have to give you what constitutes a false name?
Chair Prezonsky, Senator Thatcher, I think the law states that it's a false or fictitious name. So it's either a false name or a fictitious name, a name that they make up. Many times they use the name of a sibling because of a close physical description.
So it's not if they have a nickname, that type of scenario in the sense of law, or they abbreviate their name. It's basically, and I've seen these cases where someone does, in fact, use a relative, and it's very unfortunate when the relative finds out that they have been had a warrant issued for their arrest because their relative decided to use their name and date of birth, and they were close enough to carry that out. Senator Manning.
Mr. Chair, real briefly, sometimes those things occur. Say, for example, you got a family member that's out collecting a bunch of parking tickets, never tell the owner, and the owner is driving. Whatever happens gets stopped and said, oh, there's a warrant out for unpaid parking tickets. Those are pretty common. They happen quite a bit. Or if someone has a bench warrant out and they're driving and has a violation, a moving violation, they run a check and they find out that there is a warrant for that person pending. But sometimes, like in the cases of these parking tickets, unpaid parking tickets, if you're the owner of the vehicle, I know my son got a parking ticket and I got a letter from the state saying that he got a parking ticket and I had no knowledge about it, but he paid it. So those are just a few instances when those things could happen.
All right. Any other questions?
Tim? Just one comment. It just seemed like a Class A misdemeanor. It just shocked me that it would be that high.
That's what it's always been.
I guess.
It has been.
This is not new.
All.
Yeah. All right. Tim, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony that wasn't here yesterday, or who was here yesterday for 2987? It was carried over from yesterday. We'll close the public hearing. We're going to now start our other public hearings. We have a number of members that are here, and Senator Roble, I understand you're supposed to be in committee at this point. So, and you're here on the 2673A. I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing to take Senator Roblin's testimony and Representative Knowles.
Thank you, Chair Prezonsky. Members of the committee, House Bill 2673A provides an alternative process for persons to change their name and gender on a vital record. It also eliminates the requirement for courts to publicly post court orders on name and gender changes. There are no amendments. There is a minimal fiscal and no revenue impact.
All right.
Rob, you're going first. Thank you. Chair Prezonsky, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rob Knowles, State Representative for House District 42, which is southeast and a little sliver of northeast Portland, and I'm pleased to be here before you this morning in support of House Bill 2673A, a bill that seeks to create a safer, more efficient process for a transgender Oregonian to update their name and gender marker on their birth certificate to more accurately reflect who they are. We know that due to a lack of societal acceptance and sometimes outright discrimination, many transgender Oregonians continue to experience severe economic hardship and instability in their lives. There was a survey done in 2015, the U.S. Trans Survey, that tells us that in the last year, more than 45% of transgender people in our country report verbal harassment, nearly 10% were physically attacked, and nearly one-third, 29% of transgender respondents were living in poverty. Furthermore, we know that only about 1 in 10 transgender individuals has accurate ID, and many transgender people avoid or delay updating their identity documents due to safety concerns, cost, and the sort of onerous nature of the process of trying to update your identity documents. House Bill 2673A directly addresses these issues. The bill protects the privacy and reduces the cost for a transgender Oregonian when they seek to update their birth certificate by creating a centralized administrative process through the Oregon Health Authority's Center for Health Statistics, which manages these vital records. House Bill 2673A also removes the outdated posting requirement for all those who seek a name or gender marker change through the court system, making the process a little safer for these Oregonians. And I'll just add that myself and the advocates for this bill, who I believe will be up to talk about later, we consulted with both the Oregon Health Authority and the Oregon Department of Justice in the process of drafting this bill. I'm its chief sponsor. I'm very proud of that, and I believe it is an important, albeit modest, step toward ensuring safety and privacy for transgender Oregonians. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have after my colleague here testifies.
All right. For the record, Arne Roblin, Senate District 5, much of the Oregon coast. Thank you, Chair Prezonsky, and the rest of the committee for being here today to allow me to testify. You know, rural Oregonians come in all sizes, shapes, and colors. We try to make our communities better. We work hard to do that. In high schools, like the one I was a principal at, there are kids who are working hard to figure out who they are and where they belong in that society. And keeping all of them safe as they try to discover that is really, really important. From my perspective, I think sometimes people think that only transgender Oregonians live in big cities. That's not true. They live everywhere. And I'm here basically because in my life history, my parents were very strong on a couple things. Respect every other human being and listen carefully. Listen not only with your brain, but listen with your heart. And if you do that with people, they will let you know where they are and the struggles they're having, and you can maybe help them by giving them the respect they're due. As a kid growing up in Port Angeles, Washington, a lot like the places that I lived in Coos Bay and North Bend, I had an exceptional teacher who taught me about drafting. And it was probably the best class I had in middle school. And I had come, as people know, as a dyslexic kid to middle school feeling very, very alone in the world and not being able to figure out stuff. And all of a sudden, I found this teacher and this classroom that let me compete with people in all levels. I spent my whole Christmas vacation drawing and drafting so I could take stuff into this person. About 10 years after I was out of the high school, and this was in middle school, it came to me because my sister called and said, "Remember your teacher from middle school?" And I said, "Yes." And I said, "Well, He has decided to let people know that he's been living a different life, and he's looking at having a sex change operation. And he's living in Coos Bay with his wife, and they have come to this conclusion as a family. And I said, that's amazing. Wasn't something that interested me or thought of being an issue with respect to my teacher. It was just that my sister knew how much I cared about this person. And part of the requirement was that he had to dress and become the woman he was going to become. And in our community, like Coos Bay, that's a really tough thing to do when you've had hundreds of kids go through your classroom, have a totally different opinion of you. He did not make it that year. He committed suicide about 9 months into the situation. And it is still a part of my heart to think that our society and our community did not have enough respect for that human being to give him what he needed to be able to make a decision that was important to him and his family. So for me, this is just a continuation of that conversation that is needed to take place to allow people to respect one another, to help them by listening to them clearly, and allowing them to be who they are. So I encourage you to pass this bill and to allow people to help make decisions for themselves and for our society to respect those decisions and not put them in harm's way.
I had no idea.
Yep.
All right, thank you. Questions for the senator or the representative? Senator Thatcher.
Hey, thank you. I just want to put this question on the record, launching it to you,
sure.
Not because I'm looking to kill your bill or anything, but I know on the House side they were talking about adding a whole list of people to be able to do this. Now, I would pare that down maybe at this point to maybe just sexual assault survivors who may want to change their identity for, you know, whatever safety reasons, same kind of reasons in a way. And I'm wondering if you would be amenable or think about, you don't have to answer me right now, to such an amendment. And that's, I just want to throw that out there.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Thatcher, we did have a discussion about that. And I think that is a very admirable thing to try to contemplate. And honestly, the reason why we did not amend the bill to include some of those things, there were other categories of folks who wanted to be added, was it would have created a fiscal for the bill. We believe the Office of the Health Authority's Center for Health Statistics and Vital Records is pretty small. It's like probably one or two people that run it. They do not believe that they're going to be overwhelmed with very many folks that are going to want to take advantage of this. And so therefore they feel that they can handle the workload. And I don't remember what the estimates were, they said if we broaden it out to other categories of folks who might benefit from this, it would probably generate more workload, and so that's why we crafted it so narrowly.
And Mr. Chair, and that is why I thought to pare it down to only sexual assault survivors, because I doubt there'd be a big rush for them either. And I've been trying to have a conversation with the various entities, and I haven't gotten to that conclusion yet. So I was wondering if that doesn't create a large fiscal.
It might.
I don't know. Anyway, just throwing that out there. Just
right on.
Thanks. All right. Any other questions? Thank you all very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to recess this bill because I have another member here. I need to take their testimony. We will be coming back. I know we have at least two panels that will be giving testimony in support of the bill. So at this point, we're going to go ahead and recess House Bill 2673, and we'll be right back to it. We're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2113.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. House Bill 2113 adds secular organizations to the list of entities authorized to solemnize marriages, and it also defines secular organization. There are no amendments, and there is no fiscal and no revenue impact.
Representative Greenlick, what I'm going to go ahead and do while we're taking your testimony, I'm going to ask Kimberly and Brian if you two will come on up since this is kind of the top of the agenda. We'll work through this bill, and then we'll come back and pick up the one we just recessed.
Hello, sir.
Hi. Representative Greenlick, whenever
you're
ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33. I'm here to bring you up. House Bill 2113. This bill has been wandering around in the desert for a while. I hope we're on the top of the mountain looking into the promised land for it. at this point. What happens when somebody wants to get married is they go down to the county and take out a marriage license. And then they go get married, and somebody officiates at that marriage. And then somebody has to sign their marriage license solemnizing that they actually did get married. There are three categories of people that can solemnize marriages under current statutes. One is a clergyman, the second category is a judge, and the third category are county clerks. This bill simply adds a fourth category to that group of people who can solemnize marriages, and that's the officiates of secular organizations that essentially fill a similar place in the life of Oregonians to religious organizations, but for people who prefer a secular way of viewing the world and of getting their philosophical basis. So I'm here to ask you, we've tried not to confuse this bill with other things. It's stripped down in its purest form now, and I hope you'll move it on to the Senate floor.
All right, thank you. And
Mr. Chair.
And Representative Greenlick, do you need to proceed to other duties, or should
I'll say for this testimony.
Okay. So I also just saw Senator Steinert Hayward is coming. I believe she also wants to make give testimony. Why don't we bring another chair up?
Well, I can move back.
Okay. I'll be quick. I promise.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, State Senate District 17. I'm honored to be here with my colleague and co-representative of that area, Representative Greenlick. We had a talk with you about this bill 2 years ago. We got a little ambitious and tried to put legislators in because many of us would like to be able to perform weddings as well without having to go through what I went through when I wanted to perform a wedding for friends of mine, which is get certified. As many do, by the Universal Life Church. And I actually had to go to my rabbi and say, do you object to my doing this? Because I'm obviously a person of pretty strong faith, and I wasn't getting ordained in my religion. And he said, no, it was good. But it would have been nice, because we're all of my friends and I are actually part of similar organizations that would be covered by this bill. And it would be nice to be able to do it as part of that process as well. People find strength and community and spiritual solace in ways that aren't traditionally recognized by organized religion. Oregon is, for better or for worse, the most unchurched state in the nation. We have the most people who do not affiliate themselves with any particular faith tradition, and we need to give them the opportunity to have someone who has meaning in their life to perform a ceremony for them that has substantial meaning and that sets them on the path for the rest of their life in a meaningful way. And although one can form good relationships with judges, my husband and I certainly did with the judge who married us, it would have been better if we could have had a good friend who had known us for a while do this for us. And this just gives us the opportunity to let Oregonians who choose a different path towards community and inquiry in life to move forward and have that kind of participation in one of the most special days of their lives. And I urge your support.
All right.
Happy to take questions and happy to relinquish my chair.
Yeah, do you need to get back to your committee?
No, I've got, well, not till 9. I'm good.
Okay. Let me just see if there are any questions for the representative or the senator.
I do have a question. So what would be examples of organizations that you're thinking of?
Do that, representative?
I didn't hear the question.
What would be some examples of organizations that you have in mind to be able to, you know, perform the marriages? That
I'll be getting some testimony on that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Ryan here.
Yeah.
Great.
All right. If there's no other questions, what I'm going to do is ask.
Essentially, we're talking about kind of humanist organizations as a category that.
Yeah, I think Brian will be giving us that. He's done that before. So why don't we do this? I need to make room for Kimberly to come back up. So if one of you want to excuse.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Brian, why don't you go ahead and get started, and then we'll have Kimberly after that.
Okay.
Sure. My name is Brian Harvey. I'm the state director for the Secular Coalition for Oregon, and we represent 16 nonprofit organizations from across the state. A lot of varied locations: Portland, Eugene, Grants Pass, Klamath Falls, Bend. And what these organizations have in common are that they're either secular or humanist or go under a different label, but they're communities that occupy a parallel place in the lives of their members as would a religious congregation. And these do include organizations like the Humanists of Greater Portland, or an organization called Sunday Assembly, which are expressly secular in nature, welcoming to all. But, you know, the Sunday Assembly even calls itself a congregation. It's just not a religious one. And many of these organizations currently have training programs where they train and certify celebrants, officiants. They have different terms for them. And others would wish to, but aren't sure necessarily, you know, of the purpose, given the fact that they aren't given the same status under law. So, you know, in officiating, these members can't legally marry couples. I mean, they do often officiate weddings, but then there's a secondary step where you then go to a judge or a clerk, and there is an additional fee, which I always like mentioning, just because it's, you know, depending on the county, two or three times the cost of a marriage license. There's a solemnization fee, and that's what they're doing. They're solemnizing the wedding. So for people who have a representative of a religious congregation officiate their wedding, that person can also solemnize it. It does save them the fee, which I think with regard to how government treats marriage is important. But this also speaks, I think, to basic fairness under the law, equal treatment under the law, whether or not you should have to make a profession of faith to get that equal treatment, and the fact that these communities are vibrant, are open, are accepting, are, I think, models in many ways of what we would want from communities. They only lack in law right now the fact that they are communities of faith. And so we are looking for an opportunity to allow those communities the same rights under law that they're due. And not being a lawyer, Kimberly can speak a little bit more to the fact that we believe that this brings us in line with Oregon's and our federal constitution. It is true that the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals struck down a virtually identical statute in Indiana, and that has since been extended to another state within that same circuit. So it's a constitutional matter, but it's also a matter of basic fairness, and hopefully that also gives you some sense of the kind of organizations that we're talking about. And thank you.
All right, thank you. Kimberly?
Chair Przonski, members of the committee, my name is Kimberly McCullough. I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. I thought I would actually start by reading you a quote. This is from the Seventh Circuit case that struck down, as Brian mentioned, a very, very similar statute in Indiana, which listed out that, you know, judges, clerks, and members of religious organizations could solemnize marriage, but they didn't include secular organizations like the Center for Inquiry and other secular human organizations, etc. An accommodation cannot treat religions favorably when secular groups are identical with respect to the attribute selected for that accommodation. The Supreme Court also has forbidden distinctions between religious and secular beliefs that hold the same place in adherents' lives. And that case is actually where we pulled the definition of a secular organization here. The definition is that this organization occupies a place in the lives of the organization's members that's parallel to that filled by a church or other particular religious authority. So it's not just any secular organization, it's one that plays that that type of very similar role. So people go there for community and for more, you know, moral and ethical, guidance and for all of the other similar reasons to, that folks go to a church. We really believe that if this was examined by a court here in Oregon, whether it be a state court under our state constitution or a federal court applying the First Amendment, that Oregon's current statutory scheme would also be inconsistent with the with our religious freedom under both of those constitutions. I just like to take the opportunity, because I think sometimes folks don't know this, to explain that our federal constitution essentially provides a floor of religious freedom and protections of all of our rights, and then the state can actually add protections on top of that. It can't take things away, but it can layer on top. And in particular here in Oregon, our founders were very particularly concerned about the rights of non-believers and making sure that non-believers had the same rights as folks who belong to religion. So we think there's an even stronger argument that this statute is unconstitutional under the Oregon Constitution. I do just want to highlight a couple of things. Representative Greenlich had brought attention to the fact that this is actually our third time trying to get this bill passed, and each time we had hiccups because other things ended up getting added to the bill. So this is really just pared down to the concept actually that Brian here and the Center for Inquiry actually originally brought. You heard mentioned that a prior bill added members of the Legislative Assembly. A prior bill also eliminated the requirement for recording the address on the marriage license. There were a variety of concerns that were raised about both of those provisions, particularly folks thinking that legislators might be pressured into performing marriages that they didn't want to perform, and also that removing the address would somehow create a lack of accountability. Both of those provisions do not appear in this bill. I want to emphasize that no one will be required to perform marriage under this bill. It just simply expands the category of folks who are voluntarily able to do that. So I'm happy to answer any questions if you have them, but otherwise, thank you.
Thanks. Any questions? Thank you all very much for coming forward. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 2113? Not seeing anyone. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing. I believe we have the paperwork, so I'll open up a work session on House Bill 2113. Senator Thatcher, are you comfortable?
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2113 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher moves House Bill 2113 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Senator Thatcher?
I was going to talk offline. I didn't know we were going to be moving this right now, but I had some reservations last time after it had passed the Senate floor. I had read an article, I think it was an Oregonian article, anyway, talking about forced marriages, and this would make it easier, and that just kind of sticks in my mind as something that would make it easier for sex traffickers.
Forced marriages, could you put in the context, and it's sense of,
because it can be pretty much anybody out there, any organization in which you feel is your place to go to. Anyway, those are my reservations.
Okay.
And I just want to state I will be a no.
Okay. I have over here, I thought Senator Manning, did you have your hand up, or was it Senator Dimbrough?
I did. I was just going to say I'm still partial to the more expansive version, but I think this is a good step in the right direction.
All right. Senator Lithicum?
It seems like we're a little at odds. There is no requirement for the performance of solemnization of a marriage. That's a voluntary aspect of marriage. And domestic partnerships are free to follow the dictates of their own conscience and minds with regard to determining whether to seek a blessing or something of that nature for their relationship. It does not have to require solemnization from the state. There's no need to walk into the state offices and pay that fee and get that from the state records office. So I think that by opening this, Where does a secular organizations start and stop and where does a religious organization start and stop becomes problematic. I would just allow continuation of those who seek some sort of religious solemnization to take that route, and those who choose not to, choose not to.
All right, Senator Manning, did you?
Mr. Chair, thank you. After listening to some comments from my committee colleagues, I did too also have some reservations, and then I reflected back to states like Kansas that have common law marriage. You don't actually have to go in and get anything signed to claim common law status and stuff, so you're legally married in those states and similar states. So Oregon is not a common law state, but those common law states do exist where this is a non-issue. So I'm, you know, while I'm an old traditional kind of guy, you know, I guess, I don't see anything wrong with, you know, someone, you know, other, you know, I don't want to impose religion as a means for a person to get married. That's their choice. For me, I chose another way. But again, there are states where common law is a practice and it doesn't require any kind of solemnization or anything. It's you live with a person for a certain amount of years or time and stuff, and you are legally bound. Thank you.
All right. So I'm just looking at, because I want to look at the definition that's under ORS 106.150 sub 2, which is solemnization, because it is defined already. I will put on the record, based on what the Seventh Court of Appeals has done in Indiana, there's something I would say of a concern that ours would be a challenge. The reason I say that is that many of our laws were based on the Indiana model when we became a state. That's a little tidbit of information that we gleaned a lot of the beginnings of our statutory regulations and authorities from the state of Indiana. I also feel that this is a situation that a reasonable step. I know that last time when we were attempting to add legislators into it, there was a concern that some individuals in the legislature felt that they were going to be forced to participate in a marriage and if requested to do one. And clearly that was an optional part. Unless you were basically holding yourself out to do marriages and the general public, then you would be more obligated to do it, because at that point you're now providing a service for the public in general as compared to fulfilling a wish of some friends who asked you to officiate. And I know that's how I was able to officiate. I had to go through on the internet to become a member of the Universal Church or whichever one it was. So with that said, are there any comments and questions, Senator Lithicum?
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to add, sort of in response to Senator Lithicum, I mean, you know, I think that it's true that there is no requirement, or there should be no requirement, for an individual to solemnize their marriage. But if they so choose, it seems they should be able to do it in a way that is meaningful and important to them, and that we should give individuals that kind of equal right. And so, you know, I think this is a good idea that we're going down this move. Marriage is an important event. It's an important moment. And individuals, you know, I think should be able to design the ceremony that has the most meaning to them and to the community that they choose to live in.
Senator Lithicum?
In terms of definitions, the who may solemnize a marriage, 106.120 subsection D, lowercase d, I guess it's 2D, a clergy person of any religious congregation or organization. it doesn't have to be a religious congregation. It says or organization. And then here's the catch, who is authorized by a congregation, again, or organization to solemnize marriages. So I think this already has that available breadth to it without us adding, you know, our modern thoughts to it. The language is already there.
All right. Any other comments? I just want to put one thing up here. See, common definition. So I'm just looking at what the common definition for clergyman is, and just make certain I'm reading from what Senator Lithicum has mentioned. So it's clergyman versus clergy person. So just gender neutral is a priest, minister, or religious leader, especially in the Christian Christian faith. So it seems to me the term clergyman or clergy person in this case has a distinction to be tied to some type of religious order. I understand that it does say or organization, but it appears that that person is somebody above and beyond what maybe would be covered in this bill, that they would not be, let me go back to where we were. As an officiant, as compared to a clergy person, and I think that
the word religious is tied to both the organization and congregation.
You know, that, I was looking at that.
It links to 106.150, and there they have it inverted where it says religious organization or congregation. Here it's religious organization or congregation.
Okay. Right. So council and I are looking at the definitions, and it seems like the term religious is tied to both as a congregation or as an organization. So I think that's the distinction here. I wanted to put that on the record. The other thing I wanted to respond to is what Senator Manning talked about was having common law marriage. This state does not, Oregon does not, and it is interesting that a common law marriage can actually be done by declaration. As I learned in Texas, if an individual, let's say, just decided to rent a room and they signed in as husband and wife, they have just now publicly declared their marriage. So with that, is there any other comments, questions? All right, we have a motion before us to move the bill, which is, again, House Bill 2113 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objections? Please note objections. Motion does carry. We'll assign Elizabeth Steiner Hayward and myself as the carriers of this bill. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2113. And at this point, we will go back to our previous opened hearing, which is on House Bill 2673A. So at this point, we have. I'm sorry? I didn't see Sal here.
Came,
I
think he came in.
Yeah, he came in. Right. Yeah, I was looking earlier. So at this point, I have two panels that are going to be giving testimony. So the first panel that I have down is Brooke is Oblio and Nora. Why don't you three please come forward? And good morning to all. What I need you to do is just put your name on the record before you give us your testimony.
You bet. Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee, my name is Brooke Chelly, and I serve as co-chair of Basic Rights Oregon Board of Directors. I'm pleased to bring forward House Bill 2673A on behalf of transgender Oregonians across the state. Basic Rights Oregon works to ensure that all lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Oregonians experience equality. This legislation is a necessary step in the right direction to ensure the rights of all Oregonians. As the organizational sponsor of this bill, we urge you to support HB 2673A because it will greatly reduce discrimination for transgender people by allowing us to safely, efficiently, and affordably obtain personal documentation that accurately reflects our gender identity. While Oregon is on the forefront of LGBTQ equality nationally, thanks to the great work of the legislature, transgender Oregonians remain among our most vulnerable and misunderstood community members. For those unfamiliar, transgender is a term used to describe a person whose gender is not the same as the sex they were assigned at birth. Unfortunately, because of the lack of awareness and acceptance in society, more than 40% of us attempt suicide in our lifetimes. And we are also 4 more times likely to live in poverty than other residents of the state. HB 2673A will mitigate this crisis, as identity documents are a crucial part of personal, social, and workforce acceptance. Unfortunately, the current court process is intrusive, expensive, and hard to navigate. Currently, updating your birth certificate requires a transgender person to go through a court request to get a legal name change or gender marker amendment. Next, we take the court order to OHA's Center for Health Statistics Department, which administers vital records. Because of the current court process, many of our community are at risk for being asked sensitive, private medical information in open court, being outed to the public, and consequently being discriminated against or harmed. Considering the harassment and discrimination transgender people continue to experience, this risk is an undue burden for many of us. Additionally, the court process is inconsistent from county to county and quite expensive as it adds another layer of court and attorney fees. As many of us are impoverished, the price is often too high for us to access. HB 2673A would make 2 simple fixes to existing Oregon law to ensure that transgender Oregonians can obtain accurate documentation that reflects their gender identity. First, it would centralize the administrative process to change a name and gender marker on a birth certificate by creating a single, streamlined process at Oregon Health Authority, OHA, for transgender Oregonians. This proposed change would not eliminate the court order option, but would provide a safe, effective method for transgender people and remove a barrier to access. Our records would still be subject to existing verification processes in OHA's Center for Health Statistics Department. This process would closely resemble the federal process for updating Social Security documentation. Second, the bill would modernize outdated public posting requirements in the court process. Currently, even if a court takes electronic petitions, a person may have to physically go to the court and post their petition on a public board twice. This onerous and outdated practice puts all Oregonians at risk of identity theft and adds logistical difficulty. However, it puts a special burden on transgender individuals at risk for being publicly outed and discriminated against. As a senior engineer, I'm one of the fortunate ones. When I decided to leave Texas, a state that does not recognize my gender, my skills were sought after by companies across the country. I chose Oregon because of the robust technology industry and the value that our state puts on equality. However, we're not done. Passing HB 2673A is an important step in an effort to ensure that all Oregonians are treated with dignity and respect and can live free from discrimination. We strongly urge that this committee pass this bill. Thank you for your opportunity to testify today.
All right, thank you. Who'd like to go next?
Go next.
Okay.
Chair Senator Prozanski and members of the committee, my name is Oblio Stroyman, and I'm the executive director for Transponder, a transgender-founded and led nonprofit created to empower and support trans and gender-diverse people and our allies. We're based in Eugene and provide support to hundreds of transgender Oregonians and their families in Central and Southern Oregon. I'm here on behalf of Transponder and to share my story in support of HB 2673A, a bill to help transgender Oregonians. Transponder was started by necessity by a couple of us who are navigating systems that do not easily affirm us and at times is downright frightening. One of the major obstacles we have each faced personally and is of major community concern is the name and gender change process. The obstacles we face are monetary, bureaucratic, and psychological. As a professional in the mental health field with an alter-abled son, the cost of updating my identity documents was a monetary barrier for years. Even if I made my own documentation changes a monetary priority, I didn't know where to go or who to talk to support me in updating my identity documents. This process is confusing, cumbersome, and requires medical visits and a public, personal, private information to make public, private, personal information. There are psychological and emotional barriers, and it poses a very real threat to my safety. Currently, only some of my identification documents has my correct gender, which causes confusion when I'm asked what my legal gender is. This outs me in ways that feel unsafe. This past year, I finally took steps to make all my documents congruent, and I'm anxiously awaiting completion of this process. My name and address are currently posted at a courthouse in a public gender-changing posting available to any past or current client of mine or any member of the public. As a mental health professional, privacy and confidentiality are paramount. I have already had an experience in which a former client sent me a threatening message via social media after I'd made a mandated child abuse report. I'm terrified about what would happen if he saw my posting. By the time we step into a courtroom, transgender Oregonians have already had psychological and medical professionals affirm, under perjury of law, that we are fit to move forward in our gender and name change process. This should be enough. Our court hearing should be a day of celebration, making all the obstacles we have overcome a time when we will be seen as who we are, rather than a day full of fear, red tape, and potential violence. At Transponder, we work hard to find ways to streamline the process for trans and gender diverse people, yet every week we hear stories from community members who've had difficult experiences, including from Transponder's administrative staff, who are college educated and employed. How can we expect our members, many of who are underemployed and emotionally vulnerable, to be able to do this alone and complete it emotionally unscathed? We serve rural Oregonians who travel miles to attend our meetings or use the internet to reach us for support because they do not feel safe to seek support in their own communities. They share with us that it's downright dangerous to have incongruent identification and that it is a barrier for them to obtain the services and employment they need to live. We know that when we do not have proper documentation, we are more likely to avoid medical care, more likely to get questioned by law enforcement, and more likely to be outed in unsafe situations. We have higher instances of depression, anxiety, and self-esteem directly related to gender-affirming obstacles, and this contributes to challenges in seeking and maintaining gainful employment. I have experienced these things personally and professionally, and these realities are well documented in the 2015 United States Transgender Survey. In this political climate, where states like North Carolina have implemented discriminatory bathroom rules and the federal government has reversed protections for transgender youth, I urge you to demonstrate Oregon's leadership for transgender equality and human rights. I also want to add that my name change, my name and my address were stolen from the public posting when I made the public posting and I went back to bring it into the court. So it was taken. Today, the name change process is inaccessible for people monetarily and psychologically, and it's potentially unsafe for people like me. HB 2673A is an opportunity to put this process in reach of transgender Oregonians and help us thrive. You have the power to improve the circumstances and improve the lives of transgender people like me. Thank you, members of the committee, for the opportunity to speak. I urge you to support HB 2673A.
All right, thank you. Nora?
Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee, as an attorney, I am obligated to introduce myself under my legal name, Kyle Rausch, but I would, please to reintroduce myself to you under my preferred and soon-to-be legal name, Nora Broker. I'm here today to support HB 2673A. I believe deeply that this bill is a necessary measure for the state to take on behalf of trans Oregonians. And this belief is based on my experience as an Oregon native, as an attorney who assists trans clients to navigate this process, and as a trans Oregonian myself. I'm currently in the process of my own legal name and gender change, and I have a hearing set at Multnomah County in late May of this year. On the one hand, I'm lucky. Thanks to my career, the court is largely demystified for me. Nonetheless, the process is daunting, and I can't imagine going through it without legal training, and I've certainly helped other clients who encounter problems in standard petitions that could not have been resolved but for the assistance of legal counsel. When I help others through this complicated and intimidating process, I must translate rules and requirements that often bear little resemblance to clients' lived experience. have to explain why deeply personal information must be dragged forth for public inspection, and I may have to prepare clients to face needless scrutiny and doubt. As a severely marginalized community, trans people have learned a deep mistrust for the official institutions that have for so long treated them with skepticism, scorn, or worse. It's even more daunting for groups such as trans people of color who face marginalization on multiple fronts. A request such as posting personal information on a public bulletin board may seem trivial to many people, but for a trans woman of color who has faced domestic abuse, that request may sound very different. So I grew up in Corvallis, and it's a pretty small town, and trans people in small communities face extra challenges. We may know that we're different, but we may have no one in our daily lives who provides an example that makes sense. Further, in a small community, everyone is under close scrutiny. Your life is inherently public because everyone is so aware of one another. And this makes it all the more terrifying to face posting a name and gender change publicly or to face a hearing in open court. Folks in small communities like my hometown have a particularly compelling need for a more private pathway. So I was raised on Oregon values, and I feel so fortunate to be born here. I look around and I see so many people who are ready and eager to take a stand for fairness and equality. And by passing this bill, the legislature would take great strides towards fairness and safety for trans people. This bill presents a wonderful opportunity to channel the words of former U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch and to show trans Oregonians clearly and unequivocally that their state sees them, that their community respects and trusts them, that Oregon stands with them and will do everything it can to keep them safe. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
All right, thank you. Questions? So, Nora, this may be a question for you. I'm familiar with the process. My wife went through it to change her middle name with the posting and all that. The only thing I'm concerned with is to the notice to creditors. And can you walk us through how and when the name change is going forward, if it's going to be confidential, how is the declaration made so people can track whatever debt you may have is going to stay with that process?
I may have to defer that question. I'm not familiar specifically with that, but I'd be happy to follow up and get back to you.
Yeah, I mean, my understanding, part of the reason for posting is to give other people notice that someone's changing their name, so if there are debts that are acquired or accrued, that they have the ability to maintain their position for having that paid.
I can speak to that very briefly. As with the court process, changing your name through the Center for Health Statistics doesn't change your Social Security number, your residential address, or your employment, and those are all mechanisms that are currently used to track individuals and can continue to be used to do so.
Okay, yeah, I just want to put this on the record so we cover all the bases. And
certainly.
Any other questions? Senator Lithicum first, and then Senator Thatcher.
And I'm not sure so much if this is for the panel, but at what point does a risk to an applicant outweigh public interest or public notice? Because that's really what we're dealing with, is trying to keep this notification out of the public domain. And because of risk to the applicant, and I know those two scales get weighed in different circumstances in different ways. What does that look like? Council may be able to offer some insight. Thank you.
Well, I mean, that's really what we're here for.
That's right.
It's a public policy decision that we're making as
well,
to
I'm,
whether.
Well, I'm curious about current law. And how the courts weigh that, because an individual who's been harmed in a domestic violence circumstance may go through a name change in a similar fashion, and there can be a court order in the petition. It describes that, and there's a risk to the applicant that it takes precedent over public knowledge in that circumstance. This circumstance may or may not be similar, and I'm wondering what does that scale look like?
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. I'm trying to think back from when I was reviewing this bill, and if I'm recalling correctly, there were some already existing provisions for a court to seal the record that are still there. So I think that's where the court goes in for that balancing if there's concerns to seal the record. And I think they even, because Oregon has, for people that are victims of stalking, have a process for getting the confidential addresses. And I think they address that in this original law and maintain it with this measure. But it will take me a moment to look for
it. I'll supplement. I mean, the reality is an individual goes before the judge, he or she, meaning the judge, is going to take a determination based on what facts or statements are made under oath or what and whatever arrangement the court requires. And then the court's going to do a balancing. It's an individual. And they're going to say, in this case, yes, it does, or no, it doesn't reach that threshold. It's the same thing with public records. We have two different sections. If I remember correctly, 501, I'm going to probably get the numbers wrong, in 502 or 503, where there's different tests that are applied as to whether or not something that's a public record should or shouldn't be disclosed. And there is a test that the court would apply depending on which sections under. And so it's a similar type of resemblance that the court is going to be faced with a case-by-case basis and make a determination based on what's presented to them under those circumstances at that time.
And just for follow-up, I found one of the portions. I think there's multiple, but you'll see on page 5, lines 5 through 13 is what's in the existing law that's getting deleted, and I think some of those portions are getting deleted because they're not necessary anymore with us eliminating the public posting requirement, and then some of them are captured down, putting back in the bold print in lines 14 through 18, talking about applicants in the court being able to seal those records. So you can see a little bit how the original law was attempting to address that balancing.
Okay. Senator Thatcher next.
I had a question. It really doesn't have to do with the process that's being brought forward. I'm just trying to figure out what the tie is with employment. I keep hearing employment getting brought up. Mm-hmm. I'm an employer. I've never asked for a birth certificate. In fact, when you're doing the I-9s, you can't even ask for a driver license. You just have to, you know, get something from this list or two from these lists. And I'm just trying to understand if you could explain.
In what context as far as?
Well, how employment goes into this name change thing.
So one way that it goes in is just simply around financial burden. So transgender folks face employment discrimination quite often, which is unfortunate. But that can lead to people who are trans having less ability to pay for the costly court process to change their name or gender marker. In many cases, not having a gender marker, not just on your birth certificate, but other documents that the birth certificate can help enable, right? Obviously, can decrease your likelihood of gaining employment or increase your likelihood of being outed as trans when you're trying to find employment. So, does that answer your question?
Kind of. And if you think of something else later, you can get back to me.
Yeah. Certainly. Well, and not having congruent documents that affirm your gender identity is emotionally and psychologically upsetting, you know. And so we see a lot of folks, I work in mental health, a lot of folks with depression and anxiety, and these obstacles and these barriers and navigating these systems by oneself can really take a toll.
Right. I understand that. I get that. I can understand that. I just was trying to figure out how employment got into this. That's what I was understanding.
Sure.
Thank you.
Other questions or comments? Thank you all very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
Our next panel, is Margot, Lisa, and Neola.
Good morning, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. My name is Nola Young. I'm a transgender advocate here in Oregon. Wanted to maybe start with possibly adding a little bit more information for your question, Senator Thatcher. So when we look at employment, when you do different verification of employment at hiring, typically, you use different kinds of documentation to do that verification. When you have incongruent documents, it can cause a delay in hiring. It can cause delay in getting paid. I mean, you know, those things that we do employment for. I hope that adds a little bit more context for your question. Great. Thank you. We're going to go in a little bit different order, I think, than we planned. I can go ahead and start. I'm here to voice support for HB 2673A, removing several barriers transgender Oregonians face when updating crucial identity documents. Over the past 5 years here in Oregon, I have worked as an advocate for transgender Oregonians seeking IDs that reflect their accurate names and gender markers. Having updated identity documents means more access to important activities like getting a job, enrolling in school, opening a bank account, purchasing insurance, all examples of how we improve our quality of life and in turn improve our communities here in Oregon. Some trans people who use an ID that doesn't match their gender or gender presentation face harassment, humiliation, and violence. They're more likely to be denied jobs, housing, and healthcare because of the need for verifying identity most often. I personally assisted more than 100 transgender Oregonians in updating documents because I know that it is always life-changing and possibly life-saving. For a population that already suffers disproportionately from hiring discrimination, unemployment, poverty, all the things you've heard about from previous panelists, every extra step and extra fee can create more barriers for getting accurate identity documents. For any Oregonian to update their name, including transgender people, you must get a court order, which involves many steps, including the public posting and questions before a judge in open court. However, there is a significant difference in changing your last name from Smith to Jones, or changing your first name from Jennifer to Jack. The latter example greatly increases one's risk because it reveals deeply personal information due to our often gendered nature of names. I work in healthcare, where patient privacy is taken incredibly seriously because revealing someone's personal health information can compromise safety and access to care. This bill addresses that issue for transgender Oregonians because it gives us the option to increase our privacy by eliminating those questions in open court and the public posting requirements to reveal very sensitive health-related information. Additionally, by eliminating the requirement for a court order to update the Oregon birth certificate, it reduces the associated fees and greatly streamlines the process. Oregon can ensure that transgender and gender diverse people born here every year will be far more able to find work, to travel, and to participate confidently in our communities. I urge you to approve HB 2673, knowing that you will make our lives safer and improve our quality of life, which eventually benefits Oregon.
Thank you. Who'd like to go next?
I can go. Good morning, Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is Margot Presley. I'm a nurse practitioner and primary care provider here this morning representing the OHSU Transgender Health Program. The OHSU Transgender Health Program strongly supports House Bill 2673A. This proposed legislation would make two simple fixes to existing Oregon law to ensure that transgender Oregonians have access to a safer, more affordable, and streamlined process for obtaining documentation that accurately reflects one's gender identity. As Nola stated, currently, to update one's birth certificate, a transgender person must go through a court to request a legal name change or gender marker amendment and then take the court order to the OHA's Vital Records Department. Many transgender Oregonians fear being publicly outed by having sensitive medical and personal information disclosed in open court and their gender and names changed, posted on a public bulletin board. Some courts also require the disclosure of intrusive evidence of gender transition. The current process increases transgender people's vulnerability to violence and discrimination and the resulting ill health effects. In addition, the court process is inconsistent from county to county and can be costly and difficult to navigate. Many people who are transgender cannot afford representation to guide them through the process, as transgender Oregonians disproportionately have lower incomes and increased rates of poverty, often due to discrimination in employment, education, and healthcare settings. Having a corresponding and affirming name and gender marker can facilitate access to education, employment, and housing opportunities, which are three of the most important social determinants of health. I can say from experience that name and gender identification is at the forefront of patient interactions in healthcare settings. The ramifications of incongruence between a person's outward presentation and the gender listed on their identity documents can include being refused service by medical personnel and being refused insurance coverage for what's considered cross-gender healthcare. Having more accessible process by which transgender Oregonians can acquire legal name and gender identifications that are affirming to one's gender identity is surely an opportunity to remove a long-standing deterrent to accessing both preventive and urgent health care, particularly in rural areas. Removing barriers to care can help reduce the striking health disparities present in the transgender community. The OHSU Transgender Health Program, launched in January 2015, provides safe, comprehensive, affirming health care for the transgender and gender expansive communities. We endeavor to improve the community's overall well-being through education, research, and leadership that responds to the health care needs of transgender and gender expansive people throughout Oregon and beyond. To that end, OHSU Transgender Health Program encourages you to approve House Bill 2673A. Thank you.
Thank you. Lisa?
Yes. Good morning, members of the committee and Chair Brzozinski. My name is Lisa Rackner. I'm an attorney in Portland, Oregon. I practice in energy law, but I'm also a volunteer with the ACLU and Basic Rights Oregon. Over the past year, I've represented several transgender clients in an effort to update their names and gender markers in the Oregon courts under the current process. I've done so on a pro bono basis because so many transgender clients can't afford to hire an attorney to represent them. This process has been incredibly important to my clients. Having documentation that affirms who they truly are and that matches their presentation is essential to their well-being. On the other hand, the process is incredibly invasive, and it's also unnecessarily complicated and confusing, even for an attorney. House Bill 2673 will provide transgender people with a safe and efficient and private process to obtain the documentation that affirms their identity, and I urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Thank you all very much for coming forward. That's all I have scheduled, at least written, as to on the witness registration. Was there anyone else who did not sign up who wanted to give testimony on House Bill 2673A? All right, not seeing anyone. Brooke, I'm going to ask you to please come back up since you're representing Basic Rights Oregon. You may be able to answer a question that has been posed. The question is, can you tell us what other states, if any other states, have taken this track of legislation, so we just kind of have that as part of the record?
Unfortunately, I don't have that ready for you right now, but I can defer and get that back to you for sure.
I know there are different lifelines out there, and so I'm just wondering if there's anyone here who might have that information that could come forward to answer a question one of the members had.
Sounds like Nola will help us out.
Yeah.
Thanks.
And just for the record, if you'll go ahead and put your name on the record again, so we'll have that.
Yeah, my name is Nola Young. Most recently, California has looked at some of the changes in laws that are similar to looking at. We have many states who have things like public posting requirements, some states have things like taking an ad out in a newspaper to notify people of your name and or gender marker change publicly. There are also some states that do similarly of what Oregon has right now with public posting. California over the last few years, I think since 2013, has looked at different ways of opening up access and protecting privacy information.
All right, thank you. Any questions or comments? Thank you all very much for coming back up. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2673A. We have the paperwork and everything?
Yes.
Are we wanting time on this?
I would prefer a little time if you can afford it.
All right. So what I'm going to do is members would like to have a little time. I'm going to go ahead and carry this one over. Today is Wednesday. I'll carry it over till tomorrow. For work session, so we'll put that on the record, give individuals an opportunity to committee here to reflect on what we've taken in today. So with that, we have one other bill that we have scheduled for public hearing. Let me go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2920A.
Thank you, Chair Przanski. Members of the committee, House Bill 2920A allows a judgment debtor to file a motion for an order declaring satisfaction of a money award 10 days after requesting the satisfaction document from the judgment creditor. It also removes the requirement that the court must find that the judgment creditor acted willfully in failing to provide this document in order to award attorney fees. We did just get in yesterday a -2 amendment, which limits these provisions to instances following an execution sale of real property.
All right, thank you. And you must be Alan.
I am. My name is Alan Brickley. I'm an attorney with offices in Portland, Oregon. I'm here to speak in favor of the amendment. I was actually speaking in favor of the original bill in front of the House, but the amendment is certainly acceptable. Let me explain what the problem is, and then I'll tell you why the change. The problem arises in situations where there is a foreclosure sale of real property. In a judicial context, the process includes the entry of a judgment, a monetary judgment against the borrower. The method, theoretically, there should be a satisfaction of that amount or of the entire debt, depending upon the amount of the bid. However, it's very rarely done, and there have been situations in which the creditor simply refuses to do it because they've already finished the foreclosure and they don't particularly care. So the whole idea behind the original bill was to motivate the creditor to respond to a request for satisfaction of that amount. The problem with that amount sitting there is title companies and others who look at it understand how it works in the sense that it's either partially or fully satisfied. But the unfortunate thing is credit reporting agencies don't know that. And so they continue to show it as a judgment or an outstanding debt against the borrower, which then obviously affects their credit. So that's the reason for the bill. The original manifestation of the bill was written in a very general sense so that any debtor could request this information. It's been determined, at least in many different contexts, aside from this execution sale, that it would create a hardship because it takes significant amounts of time, in some cases, for the creditor to determine whether or not the debt has been, in fact, paid, whether it's due to, you know, time to clear the check, the ability of the debtor to withdraw their payment, things of that nature. So the decision was made to narrow the focus of the bill to the very specific problem that we're trying to address, and that is the sale, execution sale, and the resulting judgment or failure to satisfy that judgment in that context. So that's, in a nutshell, what happened and why we're here.
All right. Alan, thank you very much. I just want to get clarification. I'm looking at the original bill and looking at the amendment. The amendment will, in fact, replace the original bill.
That is correct.
And can you tell me what dialogue has occurred as to, from the original bill, the A in gross that is now before us, who was part of what group to modify and understand, narrow this?
Sure. The discussion took place at the time of the hearing before the House. Representative Weil asked a question as to whether or not that was sufficient time. My answer was yes. I was not particularly aware of the concerns about the determination of full payment in the broader context. Since that time, I have been in discussion with the attorneys with regard to that particular problem. I also discussed it with Representative Esquivel, who was really the person who brought this matter forward, and we're all comfortable with the idea that we can narrow it into this execution sale. I would add that there is existing and is not changed or not modified existing method in the more general context for a debtor to go through a process to get a satisfaction. It's a little more onerous, it's a little more difficult, but it reflects, I think, the concerns that the judgment creditor bar has about making sure that there's a full payment.
All right, Alan, thank you. Questions for him? Senator Manning?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to, I'm looking at the original bill here, and I don't know, perhaps you can help me understand this. Some of the language that I'm looking in the bill, it looks to me like it's designed to provide some type of remedy for the creditors if they're going after to recover some debt, but it's trying to provide some kind of remedy, in other words, you know, kind of loosen up previous obligations under this particular bill, you know, in terms of, for example, it has willfully here. It says if the court finds that the judgment creditor willfully fails, willfully has been removed out of that, fails to provide a satisfaction document. So, to help me understand a little bit more, is this bill about providing some type of relief or relieve some of the obligations as a creditor, as an obligation during the process?
Mr. Chair, Senator Manning, no. The idea behind it was to give the debtor the ability to motivate, if I might use that term, the creditor to follow through and satisfy a debt which has been paid either partially or in full. And so the term willfully was initially removed simply to allow the simple payment of the debt and refusal to do so, satisfy that is, and give the debtor the ability to ask for that to be done.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? Alan, thank you very much. Let me ask, is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on House Bill 2920A? Not seeing anyone coming forward. We're going to close the public hearing. We do not have the paperwork to do the work session on this bill, so we will get this scheduled once we get the paperwork. I assume it will be sometime next week. All right, with that, we have two other bills that were set for work session, or one that was work session and one that we can move. This morning we had the carryover on House Bill 2987. I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on that bill. This is the one dealing with renaming on the crime of giving a false information to a peace officer. Senator Thatcher, would you make?
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2987 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Thatcher moves House Bill 2987 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Chair will carry House Bill 2987 to the floor. Close the work session. And we had a work session scheduled today for House Bill 2357, so I'll open up the work session on that. And Whitney, if you can give us the overview.
Yes, thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. You previously heard House Bill 2357 on April 25th. It extends the existing judicial authority to impose contempt of court to modern business entities. We, since the hearing, got in the Dash 1 amendment that removes the emergency clause. There is a minimal fiscal and a minimal revenue impact on the Dash 1 amendment.
All right. So this was the one I think we asked for we held it over for the emergency clause to be removed. Sounds like we have that with the Dash 1, so we will need to move the Dash 1s, I'm assuming.
All right. Chair Przanski, I move the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2357.
Senator Thatcher moves the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2357. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Chair Przanski, I move House Bill 2357 as amended with the Dash 1 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Thatcher now moves House Bill 2357 as amended by the Dash 1s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Again, discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Any volunteers to carry 2357? Okay. Senator Thatcher will be our carrier on House Bill 2357. We'll close the work session there. So before we close for today, that means that we will be resetting House Bill 2920A once we get the paperwork. So that will be set in its normal course. And we did, in fact, carry over to tomorrow House Bill 2673A. With that particular bill, for members that you have questions, please reach out to whoever. I think we do have the paperwork, and it's my intention to go ahead and call the question tomorrow for a work session. With that, we're adjourned till tomorrow at 8:30. Thank you. We're adjourned till tomorrow at 8:30. Thank you.